hello, everyone. Welcome to Safe Space, the ABA podcast. I'm your host, Michelle Zeman. Be sure to listen to your two code words so that way you can earn your free CEU. So I'm very excited to have this conversation today because I talked with her probably about a month ago about all things related to, just trauma-informed supervision, and especially with adults. You know, this is something that is very different and something that we really don't get to talk a lot about, and we don't get a whole lot of exposure. So that being said, I think this is the perfect opportunity to introduce Dr. Fiorelli of Be Still, Be Connected. She's very much well-versed in this area, and I'm super excited to have her on tonight's podcast. Welcome, Dr. Fiorelli.
Thank you, Michelle. Thank you for having me. I'm excited. I love the adult side of the work. It's the passion I think I found later in the career, and I'm just happy to talk about it.
I'm so excited to dive into it too. You know, it's so interesting because a lot of us work with children, or a lot of us work with, you know, teenagers, and some people come from residential areas and some people might come from more of those crisis areas. And so one of the things that I wanted to dive into is, how did you get there? What sparked your passion?
Yeah, so I was at a cusp moment, I think, in my career. I had started working with a company and, you know, sometimes there's the promise the moon type of things happening. And it was one of those moments of, if I can't get what I need from an organization, this will be my time to pivot and to create something that's my own. And that moment came sooner than expected because they couldn't afford me. They laid me off. So I had to kind of create that pivot. And so one of the first things I found kind of in exploring creating my own organization and business was a connection to an adult residential facility, which I had worked with adults in different settings previously over the 5 years. And so once I kind of got connected to that crisis facility, seeing what they were doing, what the goals and hopes were, I was like, oh no, this is what I want to continue to dive into, continue to specialize in, and kind of dedicated myself to trauma-informed care from then on.
That's awesome. That's awesome. You know, and it's one of those things where, you know, again, I love that this is a conversation that we're having because, you know, just kind of hearing about it from the adult standpoint, adult services for disabled people are few and far between. And it's just really awesome to be able to talk to somebody who not only is in it, but is passionate about it too.
Well, and the services are far between. Not everybody knows clinically, like, kids are fun. I can be on the ground and pretend to be a dinosaur, and we can talk about all the actions and colors of the dinosaur. And an adult with a complex history, a complex learning history that has gotten them into that crisis moment is so much more clinically fascinating to me than clinical programming for littles.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, even beyond clinical programming for littles, let's dive into the 40-hour RBT training. You know, yeah. So this is something that we revolve around our kids for, but not so much with adults, you know? So what are some of the biggest gaps when that training is applied to adult clients that you have personally witnessed?
Yeah, I think, the staff that I work with go through a 40-hour training that is geared towards children, and they're being shown a video of, you know, teaching backward chaining for hand washing. And most adults, that's not the strategy that we're going to use. We forget that our prompt hierarchy also relates to our own vocal behavior and how we're prompting an adult. And so I think sometimes instead of the least to most for physical to partial physical to gestural to whatever is built into your hierarchy, actually being able to apply that hierarchy to your language as a prompt is a huge gap for RBTs. Like, we don't think of the full direct verbal, a partial direct verbal, an indirect verbal prompt, and all these other ways that we can scaffold those up. So that's a huge piece. Discrete trials, right? There's a heavy focus on DTT in the 40-hour training. And that's just not, like, we could do that with adults for certain adults that need that. But the research and the learning opportunities that would be required to quote unquote, like, master it, like we would for a little in DTT, that flexible learning isn't necessarily always there for adults. So it's balancing what's the actual better clinical, you know, risk benefit. Are we going to spend 800 trials to try and teach X, or can we find something functional? And what's the functional natural teaching moments too? So those are, like, two of the things that I've seen that have stood out so far.
You know, and I could definitely see that, especially, like, yeah, you know, talking a lot about DTT, you know, there is such an emphasis on DTT, not even just in 40-hour training, but even just, like, working with littles. You know, we tend to focus a lot on how can we teach these specific skills, but in an adult's world, that's not natural for them.
Yeah, and it's such a good skill for us to have as behavior analysts, to be able to think discreetly about things, right? In our analysis, in the way that we are thinking, like, what are we going to try to embed into this environment? But in the setting that I work within, or a lot of adults, right, you're working, just like we work with littles, in their home environment, but the home environment for an adult is a different home environment than a little, where you have a parent and siblings. You know, we're not necessarily going to treat their home like a 24-hour treatment environment. And I think that sometimes what some of the powers to be forget on certain times is, like, you have all this time with them. I do, but they're adults and there's different routines and it is their home. And so that comes in differently than it does with littles, I think.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, thinking about that and also shifting into, like, the RBT training, you know, how have you guys been able to implement the 40-hour RBT training, but with adults in mind, you know, not just looking at it from here are these videos of mommy or a therapist working with their, you know, 5-year-old child, but how have you been able to take that into those, you know, situations where there has been crisis situations occur, and same thing for older adults?
Yeah. So one of the tools I really relied on in the beginning, so I always mispronounce his name, but I believe it's John Guerrico. He has the adult core competencies. And within that, there is a observation or staff interaction form that he has designed and utilized. It's called PEARL. So it looks at positive, early, all, reinforcement, look, and soft. So there's 6 pieces, and those all correlate to different staff behaviors. So one of the things I did for the RBT comp specifically was I took the RBT comps assessment and I took that staff interaction scale and I overlaid what in the comps is an observable skill in the way that they're interacting, that I can kind of go, if you get an 80% on this interaction, I'm seeing you implement naturalistic teaching. I'm seeing you prompt in a natural way. I'm seeing you do natural preference assessments in the way that you're available and open to people. And that's kind of shifted over time, where I've used his tool, but then also now I've kind of created a tool of my own that incorporates some of those same things, but also psychological flexibility targets for RBT behavior.
I love that. I love that so much. And I think it's definitely, you know, it's one of those things where, again, you know, we need to be able to not just learn how to complete skills for a competency with, like, one specific target audience in mind, but if we're going to work with a variety of clients, a variety of ages, a variety of settings, you know, that's definitely one thing that I feel like the competency can really work on sort of being a little bit more flexible about, you know?
Yeah. And that's kind of, yeah, I've tried to do that where some of the staff have been RBTs in, like, school settings and they have BCBAs. And I just say, like, our competency process is going to look different because we're working with adults. So I have an electronic system. So there's, like, the interview ones that I have them put their permanent product question, like, answers in, because we're not doing stimulus control transfer procedure like we would with a little in the same way. So I'm like, as long as you can tell me the definition, give me an example, we're good. But the other ones on the interaction pieces, that's really what I hone in. And so I have set criteria of, you're getting 3 80s in a row on this interaction scale, and I feel comfortable signing off on these comps because we've observed how they connect to each other too.
That's awesome. And, you know, that's really what we need to look at. You know, we are trained to be, and we are told, you know, we need to make our plans individualized. We need to, you know, look at our clients' treatment, for lack of a better term, as an individualized treatment. But at the same time, that has to go for the way that we're doing staff training, especially given the population.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. One of the things that I was curious to know too is, you know, how should the approach shift when an RBT is working with adults, you know, especially those that are in that residential care dealing with complex trauma and psychiatric diagnoses?
Yeah, well, in general, I come from a more holistic kind of viewpoint. So I try to bring that into the RBTs. And I guess, you know, in our behavior analytic language, I'm trying to help them cue into setting events way more, as much as possible. And reading behavioral antecedents, precursors, however you want to talk about it. So that way we can look at where can we actually reinforce. So using Hanley's kind of PFA thought process of, we're going to reinforce lower level behaviors so we can avoid that crisis component. So if they're coming from a school setting, they're like, well, BCBAA over here said, you know, don't cave in, keep pushing the demand. I'm kind of going, read the situation. And is this actually an essential or a non-essential demand? So that also comes from Hanley's universal protocols. And if they're like, well, it's not essential, then I'm like, drop the rope, right? Like, let's back out of this. We don't need to push non-essential demands. And so really learning for the context, what's essential and non-essential. So I'll quiz them on, client A woke up and didn't sleep great and had a medication change in the last 3 days. What are your essential, non-essential demands? Versus client A wakes up, has a great night's sleep, medication's been stable for weeks. What are your essential and non-essential demands? So that way they can kind of go, yeah, in that first situation, maybe just literally having breakfast is our essential demand, getting food. Versus the second situation is, we're going to try to go to the mall. We're going to try and tackle that place that feels a little scary and uncomfortable for this person, but that is important to them for whatever reason.
Wow. That is really, you know, again, it really just kind of goes to show, you know, when it comes to working with the clients that we work with, you know, I've talked a little bit about like power struggles in the past, and it's like, you know, we want to look at things and be able to say, you know, we did it, we made it through. But at the same time, at what point do we say, maybe we need to pump the brakes a little bit, you know, talking about those essential versus non-essential demands. I was just talking with someone a couple of podcast episodes ago about how like there can be power struggles in what we do. And unfortunately, some of that does come from training. And it's like, you know, for example, working with a client, trying to get them to say a specific echoic, but we're told by the BCBA, oh, you have to make sure that you follow through with the demand. And if you don't, then it doesn't matter. Like, you're going to follow through with it. And I feel like that's very different coming from, you know, and this person that I was working with was a child, you know, so I can only imagine how different it must be in like an adult sense too.
Oh yeah. Most of the adults in a residential facility are going to be probably 20 to 62. Because once they hit a certain age, then they have to go to like a specific residential care for seniors or geriatric care. So most of it, they're going to be in their 30s and 40s. I know I'm 41. I have 20 years of a learning history. I can be very stubborn in a way. So if someone's trying to push me to do that thing exactly how they want it, that extinction burst in those moments or whatever, it's probably unsafe a lot of times, especially if you're dealing with acute or prolonged crisis. So for me, that's not even a choice. Like, why am I going to put somebody in crisis when we're actually trying to really build trust and stability and avoid crisis? And so I think it's Hanley that talks about like the four M's of behavior. You have behavior mollification, behavior modification, behavior medication, and then behavior management. There actually might be one more. But sometimes in these crisis settings, we're really mollifying for the environment to get everybody back to a safe zone and then look at what is actually teachable with the resources that they have. And a lot of times resources encompasses their staff training, the people that are also like collaborating care, the financial resources, the reinforcement reinforce. So like those all go into the picture of like, if we have limited resources, we might not have optimal teaching and it's just about mollification, which isn't great as a behavior analyst, but that's also like a reality to accept.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I feel like, you know, you do have to really look at the environment as a whole. You know, you have to look at their history, but then you also have to look at what their cards are, like what cards they've been dealt with too. You know, what's the environment that they're in? Also too, you know, having worked in residential for the first 6 months of my career in developmental disabilities, you know, I dealt with clients that had like abandonment things, you know, parents would abandon them. They would, or it would be like grandparents drop them off one day and they just never, it kind of goes into abandonment again, but still, yeah. Or it's like, it's too much for the family, you know, for them to handle. There was a client that I met that was close to 17 at the time that I met them. And parents were super involved, but parents couldn't handle the behaviors. And it's like, you know, now we're dealing with these clients that really don't have the support system. Not that they don't want to be in the support, but at the same time, it's like there's one less person to support them in the end.
Mm-hmm. And if you have those histories of people leaving, people abandoning, when you look at the trauma-informed piece of it, the predictability of crisis becomes quote-unquote safe, right? Like, I know if I do X, this person's going to leave anyways, right? Versus, I don't know if I actually build trust, how they're going to respond to me. And so that's something that when I look at those interactions for RBTs, the basis of my treatment intervention is relationship building with the client. So I look at if they can leave feeling like they trust and they have like truly trust, not even rapport, like they trust and feel safe with like two people in this environment, that's a learning history that then can take them to the next environment and go, I have a positive experience of trust. So I might be more likely to trust the next person, which then makes me more likely to stay stable.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Kind of going into, you know, RBTs and, you know, thinking about working with adult clients, what kinds of real world situations do RBTs face in adult settings that just aren't covered in traditional training? I know we talked a little bit about this, but give us a little bit more in terms of like, you know, what are some things that you feel like the RBT training doesn't necessarily cover when it comes to adults?
Yeah, I mean, I think even for BCBAs, the coordination of care with medication management and like, you know we're supposed to rule out medical aspects, but when you have an individual, an adult who comes into a residential facility that's been in an emergency room setting, or they're actually coming from a locked facility or jail, that they probably haven't had primary care, a dental cleaning, you know, they haven't been ruled out for all these other things. They're probably going to be seen by the psychiatrist and it's going to take months maybe to figure out medication. And so I think having an understanding of that is really helpful. And I've been, you know, in this work now for 5 years for the adult setting. And I still find, you know, the RBTs that come in or the direct service providers, the DSPs kind of are like, this happened today. Where's the magic wand, Ashley? And I'm like, well, I actually can't fix it today. And I can never quote unquote fix it, but like I can't give solutions because we've had 3 medication changes in a month. This medication actually takes 6 weeks to take therapeutic effectiveness. So I can't actually make a change for 6 weeks. And so they can then right size their expectations of how I'm coming in to support them as a consultant. So definitely like medication management and coordination is a huge piece. That again, I think goes back to that like holistic perspective because we're dealing with adults and most of them are more likely women in this environment in their, you know, 30s, 40s and above. And they have, again, they haven't been seen by primary care physicians on a regular basis because their insurance is like county services. So they get less than what, you know, we might get on a commercial insurance. And so you have women who are might be perimenopausal or menopausal, and their hormones haven't been checked. And that's a huge part of what's happening for them in those environments. And so a lot of times I become like the annoying person that's like, what's their vitamin D level? What's their B12? Have we checked their estrogen? Like, I can't look at those numbers and say, here's what you should do about it. But I think having an understanding of behavior and aging and what goes into our health and hormones over our aging can be really helpful working with adults.
I feel like, even you talking about this, it makes me think a lot about the clients that I personally work with. Now, granted, I work with more like children and adolescents more than anything. But that being said, I do have some clients that I think about like, okay, some of them have been on medication before. Some of them have had to change medication because the medication for them, they were on it for, that amount of time, and it either made things worse or they got like super drowsy or their behaviors got worse, and so it's like I think even just as a BCBA, that coordination of care is going to be such a game changer, because if you know and have a relationship with somebody who is able to, help with giving that like solid, I guess, I don't know if like advice is the right word, but just something along those lines that they're able to at least like give you some guidance and kind of like let you know, hey, expect these things, or hey, there might be some things along the way, therapeutic results may take place in X amount of time. I think disseminating that even to our technicians is huge.
Yeah, because if they know, okay, the next 6 weeks are going to be rough, but the next 6 weeks are going to tell us if this med needs to be increased, decreased, or discontinued. I think that puts them in, like, they just understand the process more versus the psychiatrist changes X and then they're looking at me going, Ashley, you're doing nothing and this behavior is increasing. So I think it just gives them that whole picture as much as possible.
Absolutely. And it is true, like, thinking about medication, certain medications have certain side effects. Certain medications may make, you feel drowsy, or you may end up having more increases in like energy. It kind of depends on what types of medication you're taking, the dosage and all of that. And I think one of the things that sometimes like we miss as behavior analysts, especially when it comes to supervising our technicians, is understanding, like if they are taking a medication, kind of disseminating that, explaining what that looks like for them, and kind of like what to expect and look out for. So, yeah. And on that, kind of thinking about like RBTs, thinking about how they can best walk into a session, because RBTs are not necessarily going to know about things like, the medication. They might not necessarily know about the side effects. They might not know certain things, right? But one of the things that we as BCBAs, are capable, more than capable of teaching is how to read the room, especially given the environment they're in, given the ages that we're working with. How can RBTs better read the room and check on a client's well-being, especially when navigating preference assessments, dignity, and assent in complex situations?
Well, I think first is they have to be like aware of themselves in the room, right? And what they're presenting in those. And a lot of that has to do with their interactions. So one of the things on that scale that I talked about before is, are they sitting in the room with their body oriented towards the client? Or are they sitting in this room and their back's turned on them, they're on their phone. And so because the residential care setting typically has 12 to 24 hour support, right? Like these staff members aren't necessarily coming in for the session like somebody is for like a 3 to 5 p.m. after school. They have their box of materials. So they're walking in for a shift. They have to figure out who's cleaning, who's doing what. So a lot of times we do visual sweeps. So like we'll visually look, is everything safe? That like, is there anything that's unsafe that needs to be put away? Is there anything sharp that needs to be put away for safety for everybody in case crisis occurs, right? So they're doing visual sweeps. Also, like the way that we arrange furniture and looking for that is a part of that. So is it really easy for someone to get stuck in a corner or behind a table if a client starts to escalate? you know, or do we have kind of a flow of they can move around all objects freely or need to like run around it in circles if they need to like evade in certain moments. And so I think those, a lot of things is like being present for themselves in the room and knowing how they're presenting themselves. Because if you're available and open to the client is more likely going to like initiate with you, come and ask you for problem solving and help in different situations. You're more free and open to talk to them when, you know, they're coming in and out of the room type of thing.
That's a really good way to look at it too, because, you know, even again, you know, working with children, you have to present in a certain way, but of course, working with adults, you also have to present in a certain way, but it's different in that, you know, with children, you know, you're more likely to show up and be silly and be, you know, more carefree, but with adults, you know, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but you might not necessarily go into that silly mode of like, you know, everything is awesome and I have my high pitched verbal praise voice, like, you know, and that can sometimes be like not very dignifying for adults because, you know, it's like, okay, why are you doing this? This is way too much.
Yeah. And it's interesting because I find the adults that I've come in contact with actually really love the silliness. And I don't know if you look at if their learning history has just been like void or decreased of a person to be silly with. And so that area of play from a trauma-informed perspective, right? When we're in a playful place, we're more connected to the person in front of us and we can actually experience aversive events more. We're more willing to experience aversive events than when we're not in that playful place. So one of the protocols that I use is the PACE protocol, which I think is Dan Hughes. So it's playful acceptance, curiosity, empathy, which actually is designed in children's classrooms. But that is a part of my plans for adults. So when we're presenting those essential demands, we're presenting them in a playful way, but the playfulness is matched to the adult's playfulness. So I had one resident who she had a level of like opposition, but in that we turned it, it was able to be a playful opposition. So she would say like, oh, Ashley, you should just go home today. And I'd be like, okay, great. I'm going to pack up my stuff. I'm going to go. And she'd be like, no, wait. I go, oh, does that mean you want me to stay forever? And so we would turn it into this game of, I would say like, bye, best friend. And she'd say, bye, enemy. And so we had this back and forth where it was just like this opposites, but it was a way to get to connect to her. So I still find the playfulness is really helpful with adults. It's just what type of play is their preference?
You know, I could definitely see that. I can definitely see that. Like now that you've explained it to me, I could definitely see what that looks like. And also too, you know, talking about learning history, that could have been something that was missing from their childhood. You know, thinking a lot about some of the clients that like I've worked with in a residential setting, you know, some of them had emotionally unavailable family members and parents that didn't give them that playfulness and that attention that they needed. And, you know, thinking about like how we can be playful, it might not be the same in terms of like a 5-year-old, but it's playful for them because, you know, we are having fun and we are building trust because we are actually kind of putting them first and also being playful in the way that they need.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So I'm going to go ahead and drop our first code word of the podcast. That first code word is sticker. That is STICKER. That is the word sticker. So thinking a lot about adult residential care, especially with clients in acute crisis or with co-occurring diagnoses, how do we create collaborative treatment plans when clients might not agree or maybe they can't fully consent to the plan in place?
Yeah, the fully consent piece is a hard one for me because there's different powers that be that, you know, quote unquote, unless there's being harm done, they're like signing intake agreements and signing papers with their names. And I kind of look at it and go, this person has not a great understanding of the 3 pages you've just thrown in front of them, but they're just putting like a big A on it. So certain people, because conservatorship, right, is a whole bigger conversation, like no one's actually assessing for capacity of understanding for some of the agreements where I think that should be happening to make sure that the client's protected in a lot of different ways. Like some clients, that someone could have come in and literally handed them a contract for a credit card and they'd be signing it, and that's not fair for them, right? And I'm not saying that's what's happening, but so the fully consent piece, just on a larger scale, and I always think about that because we do get different support needs clients that come in. You know, sometimes it's kind of like, where does their body want to go? And if you're following their body, like, okay, like we have, you know, an individual who just loves being out in the community 100% of the time, which means we're not really tackling ABLs and we're not tackling functioning skills because we're not in the home environment in the same way. But that's what makes them happy. So we're out in the community and we're like embedding things where we can in the drive to and from places. And that's what consent and willingness might look like. For the adults that have the full verbal repertoire and can say, Ashley, I hate you so much. Why are you doing this to me? This is a stupid plan. You know, I always try to present options within that. So it's like, I guess I think of it in terms of, what's my quote unquote like best case intervention recommendation? And then two or three maybe options that are not that my best case scenario might be more preferable to the client, right? And then we sit there, we kind of go, okay, well, yeah, let's try that or no. And if I can see, what I try to look out for is saying yes because of their learning history. Saying yes because staff have told them over years, you should do this, this, and this. This is important to you. This is what you should value. If I see that they're saying yes to my plan from that place, I try to pull back and come back to the table with a new idea at a different time because I don't want them to come to that from that place as much as possible, if that makes sense.
It does, actually. And I wanted to ask, how does one identify when, you know, like, let's say, you know, you have a client, it's almost like blind compliance, right? You know, yeah. You're just saying yes, because you want to, you know, comply, but you also want to like people please in a way too. Everything sounds great, but what if it doesn't sound great? So how have you as a behavior analyst kind of identified what that looks like for that client?
Yeah, I definitely think cycles, their crisis cycles can give indication of that. So sometimes there's a pattern, or most of the time I've seen a pattern of once high crisis behaviors happen and you get to that kind of post-crisis depression, there's a lot of like, I'm so sorry. I can't believe I did that. I'm Ashley. I'm really sorry. And like, there's an overemphasis on the repair where you can see like, they're like, please still like me. Right. So like, yeah. If I'm seeing that in their cycle, their crisis cycle, like those are some indicators of, I have to be very careful how I present demands, requests, because I know there's that tendency of like, please don't leave, please like me, right? And then the other thing I look out for is really when I'm offering what I have to offer or kind of recommending what it is, I'm looking for how far under the aversive umbrella are we, right? Like I'm not presenting aversive interventions unless it's like necessary based off of what's happened. But is the person responding to me from an aversive place? So do I see them subtly start to like become smaller or offer less, or are they in a more open, appetitive place? So does it seem like they're curious and there's a little bit of like intrigue about it? So that's also kind of what I look for. And so I do try to offer things of like, hey, I have this thing to talk about today. Do you want to talk about it? And sometimes it's like, no. And it's like, well, what do you want to talk about? And I was like, well, it's this. Do you want to talk about it now? Or do you want to talk about it in an hour? Well, let's talk about it now. And I said, okay. Like, so I just try to give a lot of choices through that. So it's like each step of the process, but then while the conversation's happening about here's the recommendations, I'm looking for, is the person in front of me like opening up and engaging with me, or do I feel them closing off and kind of going under that space of aversive responses more?
That makes perfect sense. I mean, I could definitely see it where it's like, if you start to open up, then that's where ascent really starts to happen, where it's like, okay, you know, you're starting to elaborate, or, you know, someone who might not be able to elaborate, like you might notice certain things, like they're smiling, they look like they are truly enjoying themselves and are happy. Where, you know, that blind compliance of just like, yeah, I'll do it. Yeah, I'll do it. It's almost like, at this point, am I truly helping you or am I not helping you?
Mm-hmm. And I think one of the realities to face if you are in the adult world is, and depending on the level of care that the adult is receiving, a lot of times what has gotten them to like a more acute crisis place is a history of learning under aversive context and control, right? Like they keep moving up this level of support and they need more and more support. So there is a level of understanding just from like theoretical history that when somebody is learning under aversive context, it's really hard to shift over to appetitive learning. So I'm not saying program aversives, but I'm saying that's a reality to kind of go, I could program gazillion reinforcing appetitive strategies, and until we get to that place where I might sprinkle in this one aversive context that then gets them to maybe experience the other reinforcing things, but they're still under like a little aversive umbrella, like that actually might be the way. And I don't say that lightly, because I know nobody wants to program aversives, but I think if you have somebody under an aversive learning history, it's just a reality. It's really hard to shift over to appetitive learning.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Especially just knowing their overall learning history, knowing where they came from. And also too, you know, just their overall life, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and also too, along with that, you know, you mentioned conservatorship, and one of the things that immediately popped into my head was consent with clients that are under guardianship or conservatorship. Do you happen to have experience with that? And if so, what has that looked like in your world?
It's interesting because I've almost seen kind of like the two extremes where you like look at the individual and you're like, why are you conserved? This doesn't make sense. And then you look at this other individual and you're like, you are conserved, and you there's a reason, right? There's that. And then there's the person who fits that same category kind of strengths and challenges that has no conservatorship. So it's like this very weird approach to all this. And so for that client who you look at, there's kind of like, why are you conserved? That I kind of go, these are things that your parents, your people want you to do. You're also an adult who has choices. And so here's what we can offer. And so we just take data on what's offered and accepted and what's offered and rejected. And we look at that over time to see, does that shift? And it really depends on the conservator too. So it depends on how much the conservator wants to push what they want for the individual. So, you know, there's other situations where there's been certain treatment plans that, you know, we've had to move into more restrictive measures because the clients and the conservators are like, we need to get this individual to a doctor's appointment. They haven't been in years. They're in dental pain. And they're refusing to go. So we need to move into like restrictive procedures to actually help transition them to these places. And that's rough for everybody.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I can only imagine. You know, I can only imagine how rough that must be. And even like on the note of, you know, they're refusing to go, talking a little bit about behavior support, you know, what does compassionate behavior support looks like? What does it look like when someone is in crisis? And how do you guide your RBTs, you know, to balance not only like their overall safety, but also client dignity as well?
Yeah. So, I mean, we really look at, I try to coach everybody to label intact, what are we doing in the environment? So that way nothing is a surprise for the resident or the individual. So if there is a safety behavior, I'm going to have to remove X because it's unsafe from you. I'm going to do so now, right? Being able to label that versus just reaching in to where they're holding maybe something around their neck and they think that you're going to hurt them more. And there's different ways in terms of trauma-informed language of I try to coach people how to speak slowly to the individual, how to drop their voice to a lower register so that way it's not high pitched, it's not overstimulating, how we're clearing out the room and making only necessary people there. And so there's very set protocols that I give them in terms of that, so that way it's as clear and as quick as possible that aligns with the crisis intervention training that they've had. And then we look at what is the repair after the crisis, right? How are we debriefing? And some of that is regulated by the regulations of the crisis. But I try to get them to also think about, we don't necessarily need these really big, large behavior cycles to debrief about something that's quote unquote gone wrong. We can take the smaller moments and debrief because then that helps build rapport. So if it's even just something of like a misunderstanding of where we wanted to go in the community, and there was a little bit of frustration versus someone's engaging in physical aggression or property destruction, like that's a whole other debrief because we need to do body checks and like make sure that there's no marks on people, versus just like, hey, like we got some miscommunication, like what can we do better about that? And so I think having the ability to debrief about the big and the small moments just helps those crisis moments, because there's an understanding that everybody's here and we all care about the person in front of us, and we're doing the best we can while they're doing the best that they can too.
I think it's really great that you like touched on just like the little moments too, because, you know, we don't always look at the little moments. We really tend to look at the big thing that happened, the big crisis that happened in the very end. But why aren't we looking at some of the smaller things? Because I do think, you know, I'm of the belief that whether you have a big behavior that involves, you know, crisis management or not, it's the small things that can lead to those big things. And we have to look at it from, you know, triggers, behaviors, precursor behaviors. You know, there's so many things that we have to look at, and we can't ignore those at all.
Yeah. And I think the other thing that's important is to notice and bring up the big and small moments that are related to appetitive places. So a lot of times if you're, you know, doing present moment awareness, you're like, well, I noticed, you know, I just noticed your body shifted. A lot of times we're doing that under aversive things. So then our prompts to notice for the adults become aversive in themselves because they've only been paired with aversive events. So I had a client the other day that we were sitting and just chatting in her room, and she got this really big smile on her face. And I was like, oh, I just noticed your face shifted. Like, what happened? She's like, well, I smiled. And I said, well, why did you smile? Tell me about that moment, right? Like, I want to do that as much as I do, oh, I just noticed like your shoulders dropped down. Like, what's going on, right? So like we have that balance of noticing all types of moments versus just noticing the aversive places.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I love that you brought that up too, because, you know, it's not just about, you know, it's not just looking at what happened that was bad per se. We also need to look at what happened that was actually quite good. You know, there's so much good that we can find in what we do. There's so
absolutely.
Much.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things for the RBTs, their documentation. I just recently shifted their like questions that they fill out. Previously, I had it as like, what was three good things and then the one crisis thing, right? Like trying to outweigh that. And recently I took off the crisis moment, because we all know the crisis moment. So yeah. I included questions that are, what was the highlight of the day? What was your favorite thing of the day? What was the client's favorite thing? What did you enjoy? What are you planning for the next shift that you're going to be there? So focus more on those places than the aversive places.
I love that as like a questionnaire of, you know, what was your favorite thing? What was their favorite thing? What did you enjoy? What did they enjoy? Because yeah, you know, aversives, we know what the aversives are.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, we know them, but why don't we know about the highlights? You know, I feel like that kind of comes from even just like in coming from a completely different perspective. We tend to look at, oh, you know, what are the concerns that are happening? But what about the wins?
Yeah.
What about them?
Well, and that's why, because I would ask, what are the wins? And people would be like, I'm like, the win could be the client got out of their bedroom. The win could be they decided to brush their teeth. The win could be that they sat outside in the sunshine today. It could be whatever. Like, it could be the smallest to bigger moments. And so that is where I'm trying to kind of cultivate getting them to look at those smaller pieces that are positive reinforcing places.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And on that note too, how do you support RBTs in managing behavior compassionately, offering feedback, and staying connected to progress when outcomes are really long-term and not always linear?
Yeah, I try to check in when I'm there with them, just like a general, like, how are we doing, right? What, I'm going to backtrack. So I try to have the RBTs set monthly goals. I don't care what the goals are. Like, they could be related to work, they could be related to personal things, but then it gives me something to check in with them. So some of them want to read a book every week. Some of them want to take so many steps per day. Some of them want to make sure that they do their job at an adequate level, right? But if I can check in and go, you know what, tell me about the book that you read, you know, how's it going? That gives us that space to stay connected in those harder moments, right? Because it gives us something grounded to go back to what's important to them. And just making sure to ask those questions to them. I tend to be like a very not structured person when I go into these environments. So I'm trying to build the same rapport and relationships of trust with the RBTs that I am with the clients. And a lot of times it's just sometimes sitting with them while they're watching TV, and I'm quote unquote maybe not doing anything behavioral in those moments, but it's offering that space of Ashley's seen this, Ashley's been here. And I offer the challenge in a lot of these environments is there's no like private space. So sometimes I'll, you know, if I'm going to offer feedback, I make sure to give a choice of, do you want to do it on the floor? Do you want to go outside in the backyard? Do you want to walk around the neighborhood while we talk about the feedback? And like, how do you want your feedback delivered as much as possible? And some of them, we take like walking supervisions, which is actually quite nice.
That's awesome. That is awesome. And, you know, that's also very dignifying too. You know, I've had conversations a lot about how we really do have to pay attention to our technicians because they're out there on the floor doing the things. They're, you know, they're implementing our plan, but at the same time, they're the ones doing more of the, I view it almost as like, we are the backbones. We as the BCBAs are the backbones, but they're the rest of the body, mm-hmm. you know, because, because we're holding it together in terms of like the plan and everything, but they're the ones, like they're the arms, they're the legs, they're the eyes, they're everything else.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's true. They're there. Yeah,
they really are. You know, and kind of on that too, what do you wish more BCBAs understood about supporting adults in crises? And how do we shift away from that like EI model that just doesn't fit with adults?
Gosh, I think the first thing that comes to mind is you're going to have to be really creative. So if you aren't a creative person naturally, or your brain doesn't go to those creative places, I think finding yourself a person or a resource is going to be the best place. And I say that because adults, you know, it's the world of client rights that is very different from littles. And so when we're trying to think of reinforcers, we can't withhold reinforcers the same way we can with littles to build motivation, because a lot of the reinforcers belong to the client. We can't remove their personal items. We can't remove their personal property. So when I first started, you know, it's looking at, okay, what are the resources that the environment is providing? Well, in this one setting, it was, you know, a basic white towel, basic white sheets. And so we built into the reinforcement system for a point system of, you have X amount of points, to like, you can use the house resources to go buy like a purple towel if you want a towel, or you want a tie-dye like bed sheet spread. And then that became their property, right? Like, so we were using those of, here's the basic shampoo and conditioner. You can use your own money to buy more a different kind. But if you don't want to use your money resources, you want to use our money resources, we can get you Suave or Dove or all these other things that you might be more interested in. So I think it's definitely creativity with the clients, with the reinforcement systems that you have set up, that is just different than kids, right? Like I can manage an iPad. I can follow parents' rules with an iPad. I can't do that with an adult.
Absolutely.
Unless there's a denial of rights in place, and that's a whole other process.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I can definitely understand that, especially, you know, you are, you know, you're not working with a small child, in which it's a little bit more, I guess, I don't want to say like easier, but it is a little easier to manipulate the reinforcers and, you know, withhold in certain cases. But at the same time, you know, if it's like the fact of the matter is you're in a setting where that's not going to be the most feasible to do. And you shouldn't necessarily look at it as you should try to do this,
right?
Because look at their learning history again.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And kind of thinking a lot about the setting that you're in, you know, I can definitely imagine there's a high level, I would imagine, granted, you know, I haven't worked in a residential setting in, gosh, it's been over 10 years now. No, probably close to 12 years now. It's gotta be very high stress. I can only imagine, you know, and that being said, how do you help prevent burnout and compassion fatigue in staff while also keeping the approach grounded in trauma-informed and ethical care?
Yeah, that is, you know, always a learning curve. We've done a lot of things for staff training. So we've done staff training on helping them identify burnout and compassion fatigue for themselves. We've done trainings on self-care strategies. They do a what's called a DSP week for direct service providers. So I created like a handout with different links to like journaling exercises and playlists based off of your mood when you leave work. So like if it was really frustrating, like here's your angry playlist, here's your grounding playlist, here's your I need to cry playlist. A lot of it is the awareness of those places and giving them terms to talk about it. So we've talked about fight, flight, freeze, fawn. We talk about that. We've done the like hand flipping model. I don't know if you've ever heard of that, where like your thumb becomes your amygdala, your four fingers are your prefrontal cortex. And so every setting event or trigger you come along, you know, brings one finger up and then you're about to flip your lid. If you've had so many events happen back and forth. So we have that language sometimes where like I'll walk into a room and someone's like, I'm about to flip my leg. I'm like, okay, let's step outside. Let's figure out how to get some fingers back over that thumb so you're more regulated when you go in. So we try to talk about like regulating routines, what can they do for themselves? And that's a part of those goals too. But it's always a work in progress because staff turnover is really high in those settings, just like every other place for a helping professional. But when you're in crisis and there's a lot of turnover, that just kind of feeds everybody else feeling burnt out as well.
Absolutely. It's not only, you know, impacting the client, but at that point, it's also impacting, you know, themselves in terms of how they can come in and present themselves at 100. Because, you know, we tend to talk about how, okay, like when you come in, you have to be your best self. You have to leave everything at the door. This is about the client at the end of the day. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, this is not an easy setting to be in. And this can even be too much for some people. And if it's not the right fit, that's okay.
Yep. Yeah. We've had that happen before where some people, they have their own history of reaction when crisis happens and it's not for them, right? It's not for everybody. And like you said, that's okay. We can find other things. We can help them figure out other places, but I try to just check in. Where are we every time I go in? What's our plan? How are we all feeling today? And does anybody need kind of like some one-to-one time?
Absolutely. I think that's huge. I think that, you know, strategies like that are really not just so much like trauma-informed for our clients, but it's also trauma-informed for our staff too. You know, how can we best, you know, support our staff during those particular moments too? I think that's just a really great way to be able to do that.
Yeah.
You know, and that being said, within supervision, you know, you talked a little bit about like some of your walking supervisions and, you know, how you present feedback. But what are some practical tools or strategies that you use in those moments during supervision to kind of help them stay grounded and responsive in this type of environment?
Yeah, it depends. I mean, I've had moments where I've literally just said to an RBT of like, you need to take a breath right now. Like we're in a high crisis moment and I can see them going up and it's in front of everybody. It's maybe not ideal in those moments, but if I can say it to that person, hey, you need to take a breath right now. Everybody can kind of also take a breath in those moments. So I try to do that where I can just in those places. And I do think with adults, and I'm kind of debating as I'm processing this out loud, I think sometimes with kids, there's a room for teaching maybe in those crisis moments. It's a little different than the room for teaching with adults in crisis, one because of size and safety risk and all of that. So if we are in a crisis moment that I know this staff member is too, I'm not coaching in the moment. I'm just going to jump in. I'm going to take over. I'm going to help manage that situation so we can get through it. And then I can debrief with them after of like what was happening for them. I don't want them to continue the crisis for both of themselves if it's not necessary, if that makes sense. Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, I can definitely think about that too. And, you know, I can definitely like kind of see too, from your perspective, like, you know, if you are seeing, you know, somebody in distress, not necessarily a client, but, you know, a tech in distress, you know, you do have to be able to identify those things and look at it as like, okay, you know, we need to really consider like you stepping out of the room, or maybe you need to take that deep breath. It takes me back to when I first started in ABA, and I just remembered there was a high stress situation, and I had yelled because I didn't know what to do at the time, and I didn't know that I had support back then. And someone came in and was like, if you need to leave, if you need to walk away, that's fine. But, you know, do ask for help. And I think that that's something that really like people do need to recognize more, is that you can ask for help. Hopefully there are supervisors out there that actually like listen to that too, because there are some cases where it doesn't happen, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, and I think too, like the asking for help in those crisis moments, right? Like when we're witnessing crisis, we're really watching a narrowing of the client's behavioral repertoire. And we're also watching the narrowing of the RBT repertoire, even though they're trained in the crisis plan. So in those moments, not everybody is going to ask for help because their behavioral repertoire has also shrank in those crisis moments. So I have to kind of go, who's looking like they need help, and jump in and ask, what do you need right now? How can I support you in this moment? And maybe it is a breath. Maybe it is stepping away. Maybe it's, please go grab me the bag of cookies that I forgot in the garage, because that's the reinforcer that this person's wanting right now.
There you go. There you go. That's a really good point too. That is a really good point. You know, and also too, just kind of thinking about, you know, check-ins and, you know, routines, you know, kind of helping them get back to where they are. You know, are there certain phrases, check-ins or routines that you recommend for building trust, not just necessarily, like, yes, of course, with the adults that we work with, but also with our RBTs too, that are on the floor and working with the adults?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's person to person. Sometimes it's like, if I'm with a person and I'm like, you okay? Like I can see something's off, and then they'll go, oh, you know what? I need to talk to you. So I think that kind of check-in, I also look at who's avoiding me, what RBT is avoiding me, right? Like, you know, if I've gone the last 2 weeks and that RBT happens to be always out in the community with ex-client, I might say, hey, I might send them a text like, hey, can you come back like before your shift ends so we can have this check-in? And then it turns out there was something aversive happening in their world about seeing me for whatever reason. And we're able to look at that. So I think similar is like, myself as a BCB, who do I avoid? Or I used to think when I was in like center or going and seeing more clients, of like, what client don't I want to drive to? What client, you know, am I like, oh, okay, here we go today. You know, mom's going to ask 17 questions. Where I try to look for that for other people. Where are they avoiding me? Because you know, we're not always appetitive, right? We are the supervisor for clinical growth and feedback, and it's uncomfortable. So that's the other piece I try to look in so I can kind of go, something's going on here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I think that that is just that that's so important. You know, one of the things that I've been really doing a lot of like research on over the past few weeks is biases, you know, implicit and explicit biases. And, you know, one of the things that we have to really make sure that we are checking ourselves when it comes to our biases is how is it going to affect how we provide services to, you know, especially like if we have a specific bias about something that has happened, or we might have like our own learning history that has then developed that specific implicit or explicit bias.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and kind of on that too, you know, so one of the things that you and I talked a little bit about prior to recording was something called the window of willingness. First, tell us what the window of willingness is, but then also tell us how you coach RBTs to recognize that client's window of willingness.
Yeah. So I kind of, if folks are familiar with the window of tolerance under like polyvagal theory, I kind of look at the window of tolerance, which talks about like your nervous system arousal levels. And then I overlay like that window of flexibility from from ACT and psychological flexibilities. Like we have this window of where we're flexible, and ideally, you know, over time, we're creating a widening of that. So we are more flexible. But within that ACT framework, right, there's experiential avoidance and there's acceptance and willingness. So there's what I've coined, I guess, the window of willingness. And I look at kind of those similarly sometimes. But it's how willing is the adult to engage in the process? How willing are they to do something with the RBT? And so a lot of times we talked about opening and closing before. That's what I try to coach on is where is the client opening and where is the client closing? And can we recognize those pieces? So it really becomes them cueing into like really subtle salient features that are either aversive or repetitive spaces. And if we're, yeah, so I think that's the piece. So, you know, when someone's first starting, if they're in a high level support environment, acute crisis, you know, their window of willingness is probably going to be like -2, right? Yeah. And you might get to like +2 over a 6-month period. And so that's kind of that place for them. And so, yeah, so I try to see like, where are they opening? Where are they willing? How have we also phrased it, right? So like I can ask something in a different phrase that staff A could ask the same thing in a different way, but one of those phrases is more repetitive. So how are we cueing into that differently? So like that's the overall framework and mindset that I come from that I try to like trickle down to, okay, well, we asked this question. And the second I said like, oh, I've got something to ask you, they sat back in their chair and looked down. I'm going, we're in a closing space, right? That's not necessarily super willing. So, and then if I'm like, if it's depending on, oh, well, I wanted to ask you about the hair stylist, you know, appointment that you just had. And then they sit back up versus I had some questions about how we're going to best support you and they sit back, right? So I think those are those things that I try to look out for, that window of willingness. And that type of data collection, I think I mentioned earlier, of like, we're always offering something to clients. What are we offering that's accepted? What are we offering that's rejected or declined or ignored, right? So like rejected, declined is a different behavioral repertoire than a client ignoring the offering. And are we seeing over time that the offered and accepted are going up, while some of the other ones are remaining stable, or maybe they're going up too because we're able to offer more. So that's one of the things that I check in on too, is of that simple data collection. What's being offered, what's being accepted, what's being offered and rejected.
You know, I really appreciate that. It kind of like, what I got from that was, you know, it really depends. It's like your words do matter. Your overall mm-hmm. like presence matters. But then also, too, we do have to pay that much more attention to, you know, body cues, body language. You know, we teach so much about body language within, like, especially, again, I'm going to compare it to working with littles here. We teach so much about, like, what types of body cues mean specific things. But at what point are we actually, you know, kind of like needing that intervention ourselves of, okay, you know, this person is doing this. Maybe I need to pick up on this specific cue.
Right. And also, how does it function for me as the clinician, right? I'm the other side of the equation. So if I've done something and they've responded, does it function aversively or repetitively for me and being aware of that? So I know where I'm at in this conversation with them at the same time. And I think we're trained to be such great observers. A lot of, you know, we're the observers of the space. We're not necessarily trained to be good interpreters, if that makes sense. So like, I'm thinking of, you know, I have a yoga teacher training for 500 hours under that credential. Mm-hmm. And part of that training is being in a room watching bodies. No one's talking. So you're literally like, I'm talking as the teacher and I'm watching how the person's body responds in front of me. And are they actually comfortable or uncomfortable based off of their body, the cue that I gave? And do they need more to like get into that space for their body and that, you know, yoga posture? And so I think a lot of times that's also what's coming to play when I'm in this space is I'm watching bodies. I'm watching bodies move. I'm watching, you know, them react. And there's an exercise that I've done in some peer groups of watching, like watching YouTube videos on silent or mute. So we can just, are we under aversive or repetitive spaces? Or there's been two clinicians that speak different languages to each other. So they actually can't really care about or understand the words, but they're watching bodies for, is this person responding under aversive or repetitive context?
I love that, you know, and I think that's really, I think that's huge, you know, just being able to kind of pay attention to that and kind of see like, okay, at what point do we need to kind of shift our language? And then at what point too, do we need to look at, you know, their overall body language? So, you know, I think that's crucial to look at, you know, whether you are working with an adult or you're working with a child.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I want to go ahead and drop our second code word of the episode. And that second code word is Belle, like Belle from Beauty and the Beast. That is B-E-L-L-E. That is the word Belle. So just to kind of wrap up, how can supervisors model relational skills like perspective taking and emotional presence, not just in the context of, you know, not just in the context of like feedback and meetings, but, you know, when you're actually out there on the floor with the technicians?
Yeah. First, I think the supervisor has to have the skill set for themselves, right? Can I notice and observe my own, like myself through different perspectives? And those different perspectives, not just like the perspective of another person. I think that's often what we think about is the person across from me, but perspectives over time, perspectives over my history, right? Like if past me approached this as a supervisor, what would they do? Okay, if future me came and gave me some advice, what would they say? You know, so there's temporal markers of that perspective taking that come in. That skill of noticing. So it really is those kind of ACT tools for themselves to be able to model in that space for the RBTs, because like you can't do it if you don't have it for yourself, right? And those things. So I think that's the piece is if you as a supervisor want to do this, like give yourself a mini assessment of like, how are my own self-relating skills? What prompts do I say to myself to get myself to shift perspectives? And how can I start taking my monitoring prompts to a shared monitoring space with my supervisee?
Wow, that's a really good way to look at that. I really like that. And finally, what is one thing that, you know, in the question that I wrote, it says RBT. But what can we as clinicians, I wouldn't just limit it to RBTs, what can we as clinicians start doing today to be more client-centered and be more trauma-informed within our own sessions, whether we are providing direct services, care coordination, parent training, or supervision.
It's a big one, but I think shifting from the descriptive analysis, ABC, here's what happened model, to bi-directional functional analysis in the moment. So does that make sense?
It does, but I'm very curious to hear your explanation because I'm sure our listeners will probably wonder, what do you mean by that?
Yeah. So because so there's the behavioral stream. We all know there's the behavioral stream. And we take that descriptive analysis. We're extrapolating like one rock from that stream and going, here's what was on this rock. This is what that rock showed us to give us our analysis. But that ABC co-varies with the rest of the stream. And the client is in the stream with their private events, their behavioral repertoires, their learning history. I'm in the behavioral stream with them with my learning history, my private events, you know, all of the other things. So as I move, the stream moves, they move, right? So I think that if I can understand, I'm going to say something. Yes, it's the antecedent. They're going to say something back. That's their behavior. I'm going to do something else. That's the consequence. But in that moment, I think it, for me, it goes back to, is it functioning aversive or repetitively for the person in front of me? And how is it functioning for me? How am I responding from that functional place in that moment, right? So like we can have on paper like, the function is attention, the function is escape. But in that moment that I'm with the person, that function may be they like something more. Could be both, could be neither, right? But if I stick to my analysis that said X, which has happened before, I'm losing out on that moment, in the moment functional analysis.
So it's all about presence.
Yes.
It's all about your presence. That's a beautiful thing to really just think about in general is how can we be more emotionally present no matter what? So
yeah.
Wow. What a great episode. I'm really just very like, I feel so happy that I got to talk to you about this. This is something that I've been curious about for a while. And, you know, it's really great to hear your perspective, hear your experience. Where can people find you or contact you?
Yeah. So bestillbeconnected.com is my website. There's some different services on there for BCBAs. I do mentorship. I have a CE membership of topics like this for people to get into. I have something specific to the relational observation forum, Planting Seed, which is a whole reinforcement system for group homes and adult work. So that's a great place to find, connect. You can find me on Instagram at ashnfio, so ashnfio. You can email me at info@bestillbeconnected.com. I really love connecting with people, even if it's like, this sparked a question, let's have a 20-minute chat. Like, I don't mind, you know, kind of giving my time that way, I guess. And then I think, you know, the supervision mentorship piece of this type of work is really important. I have it going for myself and I offer it for others. And so I think that that makes it more meaningful to be able to have that connection with other people.
I love that. And yeah. I am already looking forward to diving through all of your resources. So thank you so much, Dr. Fiorelli, and thank you, everybody, for tuning in tonight. I have been your host, Michelle Zeman, and I can't wait to do the next one with you guys. Bye.